Good morning, everybody. Welcome to our Accessible Technology webinar series. I am Judith Stark, an Accessible Technology Consultant for the Pacific ADA Center. The Accessible Technology webinar series is sponsored by the Great Lakes ADA Center and the Pacific ADA Center, both of whom are members of the ADA National Network. Before we begin, a few housekeeping items. If you would like to switch on closed captioning, please feel free to click on the CC icon at the top of your screen or use Control F8 and adjust your screen accordingly. A window will pop up with the captioning in that. Also, we will be providing for questions, so if you have any questions for our speaker, please feel free to enter them into the chat area, which is on the left of your screen. We will be monitoring questions, and Jim will be responding to them during the course of the session. So no need to wait until the end of the session for that. You may enter your questions at any time. Other than that, after the session, the handout for the session will be emailed to you along with an evaluation survey. So if you would please take a couple of minutes to fill out that survey, it's really helpful for us to evaluate how we're doing. So today's session is on the 21st Century Video Communication and Accessibility Act, which is quite a mouthful, and we're very pleased to welcome Jim Tobias of Inclusive Technologies to help us understand both the content of this act and how it fits within the framework of other accessibility laws. Jim has 30 years of experience in accessible and usable technology in both the public and the private sectors. He's focused on how technologies are designed and used in both education, employment, and civic participation. He has a master's degree in industrial design and began his career at Berkeley Center for Independent Living and has led initiatives at Bell Labs and Bell Corps on accessibility. He is currently president of Inclusive Technologies, which is a technology analysis consulting firm specializing in accessible information and communication technologies. And some of his clients are rather impressive. They've included AOL, the California Secretary of State's Office, Cal State University System, Cisco, Microsoft, and a host of other really interesting companies. He's editor-in-chief of the Accessible Technology Coalition's web resource and leader of the outreach and awareness team for the Global Public Inclusive Infrastructure. Jim has also been very involved in several advisory committees, and I'm sure he'll tell us a little bit more about that, but including the Access Board's Committee on Updating Accessibility Requirements in Sections 255 and 508. His favorite projects have been an innovative telecommunications relay service with integrated speech technologies, a network-based talking productivity toolkit, and AT Boogie, an award-winning music video about assistive technology. So clearly a man of many talents. So Jim, thank you so much, and I will hand it over to you, and please go ahead with your presentation.
Thanks, Judith. I appreciate that, and I'm very happy to be with you all today. I'm hoping today to be able to deliver some background information about the CVAA and what its specific requirements are and how it's going to impact the communication and video accessibility opportunities for people with disabilities along several different dimensions. But I'm most interested in making it relevant to you. So I don't want this just to be a sterile one-way talk about this law and the regulations that come from it. So you can help me there by asking questions or responding to things that I say. And of course, I don't know what you're all doing and what your jobs are and what your interests are. So that's really going to be the best way for me to make this relevant to you. I'll warn you in advance, I'm going to end with a pitch that you yourselves become more involved in the legal and regulatory processes. We are in a, I think, a kind of a high point of identifying laws, regulations, and program operation principles that will advance accessibility to ICT for people with a wider range of disabilities than ever before, used in contexts wider than ever before. And as professionals, I think it behooves us all to pay a little bit of attention to that legal and regulatory side. So I'll begin with a little bit of background on, and I just want to get a confirmation that the captioner is receiving me. I didn't open the captioning pane, but if it's possible to get a text message or something indicating that the captioning is working. So if we go back, great. What seems like a long time ago, 1996, was really the last time that we had a major change in mainstream accessible telecom laws. And this was the Telecom Act, you may remember, from 1996 that had an awful lot of things in it. But the piece that's most relevant to us is commonly known as Section 255, which imposed certain new regulations on entities in the world of telecom. But that's a long time ago. And since then, really the world of ICT, and I'll use that that acronym for information and communication technologies, a lot has changed. You could really make an argument that everything has changed, that we now have wireless phones being used by a large majority of people for more and more functions every day, more and more functions that do more and more things for us in more and more environments of use. The web has taken over many functions and certainly is a main part of education and employment and other parts of social integration. And really all of these changes were subsequent to the Telecom Act. So what we found by the middle of the last decade was that we had this disparity between what was going on in the analog world and the regulations that we had there for captioning and access to wireline telephones and things like that were there. But as these digital and online media took over, it wasn't clear what the regulatory coverage was going to be. And if you were a company that did everything analog, you were looking at your digital competitors and saying, well, why aren't they subject to the same requirements? And if you were a consumer, of course, you didn't want to venture very far outside the umbrella of the accessibility requirements of analog. So you only ventured forth into the digital domain as you had an easy option to guarantee yourself the accessibility. So there was a lot of inconsistency and lack of clarity. Around about the middle of last decade, the National Council on Disability decided that it wanted to take a survey of the legislative and regulatory environment for accessible technology. And they commissioned Karen Peltz-Strauss, who's been a leader in this field for many, many years at Gallaudet University and elsewhere, to prepare and deliver a report on where things were at about this, where accessibility was at. And as a result of that report, which, by the way, still makes excellent reading, and I think it's very clear as to where we need to be moving, as a result of that report, Karen and others began drafting legislation and began kind of socializing it with leaders on Capitol Hill who were the most receptive to arguments about accessibility and disability support in general. So the bill was introduced in 2008, and very soon thereafter, we formed an organization called the Coalition of Organizations for Accessible Technology, or COAT. And COAT had a remarkable history. It began with a kind of small steering committee of four or five of the major vision loss and hearing loss organizations, as well as the American Association of Persons with Disabilities, which is a cross-disability organization. But very quickly, we signed up many of the local affiliates of those national organizations, as well as others, just really by word of mouth. And then we had, I think, the inspired small D democratic inspiration to put together a petition asking for support for the bill. And we were astonished that within just a few months we had 8,000 people signing that online petition. And that really, you know, kind of rocketed us as far as recognition by industry and also by Congress, and I think also by ourselves. We hadn't realized how aware and alert and anxious about the opportunity, the jeopardies of digital digital inclusion, so many thousands of consumers were. So we began taking the mission much more seriously. And we managed to pass it really in record time. If you think about the ADA, I don't know exactly how many years it was circulated, but I know it was 6 or 8 years at least in various forms before it was finally passed in 1990. Ours was passed within 2 years of being introduced and signed in October of 2010. Now, the way that regulations and laws about accessibility operate, let's see, I have a question here. Does providing text output for video relate to open government initiatives? I'm going to defer that question, Judith, if you can remind me at the end, we may have a chance to talk about that. And there's another one about the healthcare exchanges, and I'm happy to talk about that as well, but that's not kind of the main portion of the talk today. But I was just about to say that there are laws and regulations on many fronts affecting about 24 federal agencies of one form or another. So we've got the FCC, and we've got Department of Education, Department of Labor for employment, you know, issues. We've got the Access Board, of course, for accessibility regulations in general. The Federal Aviation Administration, you know, the Department of Commerce. Literally every piece of the federal government, and of course the state and local governments as well, are touched by issues to do with accessibility. But that's not how government works. Government integration is kind of a, you know, it's kind of a unicorn, you know, something that we'd like to see, but really we just have vague notions of in our minds of how it would work. This particular law, I'd be happy at a later time or you know, in concert with other folks, to put a bigger picture of accessibility laws and regulations together. But CVAA is really aimed at the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. Everything in it has to do with the jurisdiction of either telecommunications or the slices of information technology that live within the jurisdiction of the Federal Communications Commission. And I won't go into the long history of that, but just to say that computers have been, you know, we looked at them as something that needs some public policy input, but the Federal Communications Commission has not always been the natural home for those kind of regulations. So if you think about software, you know, software isn't a communication function. It's a piece of, you know, computer code that lives on a computer, and the only, in some cases, the only communication that's going on is between the keyboard and the mouse and the display, and that's not really something that the FCC can regulate. But just to give you a picture of this broad, you know, arena of accessible technology policy issues that are spread across a number of regulatory and other federal bodies. So the CVAA, if you have some time and inclination, the law itself is really not that long and it's not that hard to understand, but every single thing within it points to a new responsibility or a change in responsibility to the FCC. And how the FCC works, and most of these regulatory bodies are the same, this law required, so the name of the law is the 21st Century Communication and Video Accessibility Act, normally just CVAA, Communication Video Accessibility Act. It required the establishment of some advisory committees, two of them, the Emergency Access Advisory Committee and the Video Programming Accessibility Advisory Committee. So these were personed by people who have an expertise, an existing expertise and interest in accessibility that's focused either on emergency access, and I'll be going into the details of that, or the video programming side. And there are many other pieces where the FCC got guidance. And one of the ways that they do this, and one of the ones that I'm going to ask you to think about participating in, is the cycle of public comments that they have. You know, whenever they do a law and they're about to make some new regulations, they are required to publish those regulations in draft form openly to the public with a site with a schedule for receiving comments and then even reply comments. So there's a first deadline for comments on the proposed regulations, and then everyone reads what everyone else has written and then comments again on what they've read before, and you can say some brand new things as well. So it's a very open and participatory environment. And then the FCC looks at all of those comments and replies and changes, if necessary, the proposed regulations that they had in mind, and they issue what's called a report and order. The report part is saying, well, we said we're going to make this kind of rule and everybody kind of liked it, so we're not going to change it, and that's part of the order. And here's this other rule that people didn't like so much, and we think they have a good reason, so we changed it, and the changed version is part of the order as well. So where are we at in the timeline now, coming up on 2 years after the passage of the Act? Most of the sections of the Act already have rules that have been put in place. There's a report and order for them. Not all of them are in effect, so some of these rules have a delay. Most of them have a delay of, you know, 30 days or 60 days or even a year or two or more to come into effect because they're thought to be disruptive. If you just, you know, published a rule and said, well, as of right now, you've got to comply with this. So, you know, industry doesn't generally like that. They want to be able to prepare for it, and this rulemaking procedure allows for that. So we'll go through some of the legalisms and how CBAA sits in the context of other laws. And some of this, if your main area of background or interest has been the assistive technology world, and you're familiar with the Assistive Technology Act and you know, IDEA and some of the things on the more client side that are more not mainstream so much, but the specialized AT products and services. This is going to be a new area, and again, I would encourage you to delve in here because it's really serving the same people just in a different way. So in mainstream laws, and you're familiar with from the ADA, that you know you have to comply with a given regulation unless it's an undue burden for most of the ADA. So that means that, you know, is this so hard to do that that it's going to be expensive, or it's not even feasible, or it's going to somehow distort the program, okay? So those are called standards, and there are different standards of stringency, of how strictly the rule is going to be enforced. In CBAA, the standard is achievable. So it's somewhat stronger than the Telecom Act Section 255, which was readily achievable. It basically said industry can do this really without breaking a sweat. That it's you know, easy to do. They know how to do it. It's not going to cost a lot. It's not going to make their business, you know, model fail. Achievable expects that they're going to be applying some reasonable effort and expense. So they're expected to do more than they were under Section 255. But it is weaker than ADA's undue burden, where the company or the agency would have to say, in order to get away from the requirement, they would have to say, you know, that this is something that will you know, really make us not, you know, not able to work. So let's see, the comment here, ADA standard is readily achievable, not undue burden. I thought it was undue burden. I'm not an attorney, so at any rate. So one of the other issues that has been very lively and important on the mainstream side of things is product line and portfolio approach. So if you're a company that makes a product, your argument with respect to some of these regulations is that you shouldn't have to make all of your products identical. You shouldn't have to put the same accessibility features in every single one of your products. You should be able to distinguish your products one from the other by having different sets of accessibility features, just as you have different sets of other kinds of features. So let's look at, think about a mobile phone. Mobile phones come, you know, free, or you know, $49 or $400, depending on which phone you're getting. And there are different sets of features in those different lines of products. And they wanted to be able to apply the same capability to distinguish in their designs here. And in the case of CBA, they are allowed to do that. They are allowed to take a portfolio view of their products. In addition, they don't have to build the accessibility in to the product that they're talking about. They can use a third-party solution. So if I'm a manufacturer of a phone, or if I'm a carrier selling a phone in my retail stores, I can offer to customers to load a third-party solution onto that phone, or of course the customers can do it themselves. But there are two requirements. One is that if the third-party company stops supporting that product, the phone manufacturer or the phone carrier is still responsible. They have to provide some solution that is supported, either another third-party solution, or they have to go back and do it themselves. And that the cost of this third-party solution can only be nominal. And that that is a little bit of a vague term that you know, is not, it's not clear in every, it's not a specific dollar amount in every situation. So it might be less expensive if it was an app, and it might be more expensive if it's a full-blown piece of software for a teleconferencing product. So a third-party solution would be, let's say, a screen reader that would be loaded onto a mobile phone. So I, as a manufacturer or as a telephone carrier, could provide a phone that doesn't have a screen reader on it, and any of my customers who need a screen reader could get the screen reader at a nominal cost through the manufacturer or through the carrier. So if you bought it, if you bought that screen reader, you know, on your own, it might be a couple of $100s. But if you bought it through either a manufacturer or a service provider who's responsible under CBAA, that would be more than a nominal cost, and it would not be permitted. They would have to subsidize it somehow. Okay, in the captioning zone, what we have is exactly what I mentioned at the beginning, that the digital world has to abide by the same regulations as the analog world. So the rules there are 100% of new programming, and 75% of programming that was first broadcast before the rules went into effect. So, in fact, all of the television shows that you should be seeing, with very few exemptions and waivers, do have captioning requirements on them. So that's at the studio level. Okay, so if I'm, you know, ESPN, or I'm, you know, ABC, or you know, Disney, or whatever, and I'm making the new content, that's my responsibility for making sure that the captioning is available as I transmit the programming. But of course, television is not something that only one entity is responsible for. You've got, if you think about it, it's what we call a value chain, where you've got these links that have to be connected and have to work together for the consumer, the viewer, to benefit from them. So you've got the studio, and then you've got a cable company or a satellite company, and they have some responsibilities. Then you've got a television set manufacturer who has some responsibilities. You may have a remote control manufacturer who has another set of responsibilities. You've got companies that create the electronic programming guides for the set-top boxes, and they have responsibilities. And the law affects all of them. And in some cases, I'll be doubling back on some of this information just to make it clear what the requirements are. So the pre-existing hardware requirements for captioning was that any television with a larger than 13-inch screen had to be able to do captioning. And now all screens have to do captioning. So that's not just televisions. That's mobile devices as well. So an iPhone or a tablet computer has to be able to render captioning information that's delivered by the video service provider, whether that's your cable company or you're getting it, via Wi-Fi, again from a broadcaster, what we typically think of as a broadcaster, whether they're going through the air in the digital TV frequencies or whether they're delivering it some other way. Online videos, and this is an area that I want to be really clear on, online videos are only covered if they have been broadcast before with captions. So YouTube, if you put up, your cousin's wedding on YouTube, there is no captioning requirement. The captioning requirement is for broadcasters who are taking their video programming and just pushing it out another way online. So that's all of the Hulus and all of the other video delivery systems that are online. And it only applies to shows that have already been on the air and have captions on them. Okay, so let's see. We've got a couple of backed up questions here that I think are germane to what I'm talking about here. Okay, so a projector. If a projector can act as a television, that is, it can receive broadcast information, not a DVD. There's no requirement for captioning on DVDs. There's no requirement for captioning what's on the computer software. If you're showing an online video, there's no requirement for doing it. What typically happens, and there are projectors that have this capability of decoding the captions, but if it's being used in conjunction with a computer, it's usually the computer's video card or other encoding capability, hardware or software on the computer, that's doing the decoding. And all the projector is showing a complete video image that just happens to include the text of the captions. So I hope that's clear where the technical capability is, and where the legal requirement is. So if you can take the projector and plug a cable into it, and it has a channel selector, and there are such devices, then it would be covered by CBAA. If it's just an output, a display, another display for a computer, it's not covered. Second question there, quality requirement. This is a long-standing issue. Yeah, 100% captions wasted if they're no good. And there are questions about quality. There's ongoing research on captioning quality and audio description quality that the aim is to get it to be more than just a subjective, rating, but actually some ways of measuring and identifying and objectively evaluating the quality of captions and audio description. But there are no regulations in place for it now, unfortunately. The pre-existing requirements for captions require 100% accuracy. That is, anything that's said has to show up in the captions. And there is some allowance when there's crosstalk and when there's sound effects and you know and what have you, especially in a real-time situation. But captioning quality, as you say, it's really important. And it's an issue of, you know, that's kind of grinds people. And I love the image that I get of people in the captioning community, you know, kind of watching TV like a hawk and trying to find errors and find noncompliance and report it. And that's another piece of what I'd like to encourage you folks to consider being in. Captioning is required for local government public access TV when that programming is covered by the ADA. So this was not a CBAA issue, which is aimed, you know, much more at the private sector. What does industry have to do? But captioning, just as it was before, is required when the government activity is an activity that would be covered by ADA. Video streaming is more of a facility, a technological facility. So it's covered if, as I said before, if they're streaming the content that's been broadcast before with captions. So if NBC is streaming their video, and it's been broadcast with captions, then it has to be captioned over the stream. But if it wasn't captioned or it never was broadcast, then it doesn't have to be. Okay, let's see here. We discovered that we had a CC video played in the computer's DVD player, but the projector does not have a decoder in it, right? So you have to have a decoder somewhere in the chain. And there are separate decoders, and of course there's software. Some DVD players, the player has a decoder, you know, in the player software, and those are not always easy to find and to turn on. So, but luckily there are many DVD players out there, you know, dozens, and the job might be just finding one that if you know that the DVD, if you play it on a regular DVD player, you can get the captions to play. I'm pretty sure you'll be able to find a software that can play it through your computer. Okay, let's see. Does this apply to content broadcast via internet webinars like this one? Yes and no, and I'm sorry to be mealy-mouthed about it, but this isn't really, as we're doing it right now, this isn't a video. This isn't video programming. If you were looking at me, or if I was showing some other video image, it very likely would be required. But that's under another section we'll be getting to in a minute. Educational online videos used by a university. Again, if the activity is already covered by ADA or any other accessibility law, it would still be covered. But CBAA doesn't say anything about educational online videos. You know, that would be more of an ADA thing. Is there a requirement in education caption video content as produced part of a class to be available to other members of a class who may be hearing impaired? I think that's the same answer as the previous one about educational online videos used by a university. And we can talk about that a lot. I think there's a lot of great opportunities for educational captioning, both real-time and offline or produced captions, as solutions that I think they're getting better, faster, and cheaper. Applications law for higher education. Again, CBAA is aimed at industry, not at higher ed. Hopefully there'll be spillover of some of the capabilities that industry will be doing in order to meet their CBAA obligations will expand the range of options that universities have, because we know universities are basically, they are media companies now. They are their studios, their transmission facilities. They have their own players, their own software players. They certainly have their own video websites and video administration. And there are ways that I think we'll benefit from it. That benefit from CBAA. Okay, if city broadcast city council meeting, public access also live on the city website, neither of them being captioned while appearing live. Well, again, this is not a CBAA issue. This is an ADA issue. If the reason that the city council couldn't broadcast it live captioned is a cost issue, that was an undue burden, I guess you could try to make an argument that you should do it after the fact if the cost is lower, and I know it would be lower. If I were looking to advocate, that's the direction I would go in. And I'm seeing the direction that the questions are at, and I'm sorry, I'm really not the right person to answer most of them, but maybe you'll just take it as a, let's find the right person and get them. Of course, the irony of the world being what it is, when you have the webinar with them, you'll be asking them questions about CBAA. Who knows? At any rate, so that's the, I hope I was clear about the captioning requirements and the what is required online with respect to previously broadcast programming with content. Okay, video description. The FCC had put out rules for video description that were struck down by a district court soon after the rules were supposed to go into effect back in, I think it was 2000 or 2001. And CBAA basically said, well, we're just going to reinstate those rules, or we're going to give the FCC the ability to reinstate those rules. And they are as follows, that for the top four broadcast networks, and that's ABC, CBS, Fox, and NBC, and for the top five non-broadcast networks, the cable or satellite networks, USA, Disney, TNT, Nickelodeon, and TBS, they have to broadcast 50 hours per quarter of prime time and children's programming of material that was not described before. So they can't just keep showing the same stuff over and over and claim that they have discharged their responsibility. So it's 50 new hours per quarter. If you think about it, that's not really a lot. How many hours we have per month in children's programming hours and prime time television hours, it's 5 or 6 hours per day on the average, and this is only 50 hours per quarter. And there are also some exemptions here for anything that's live or near live. If you understand how video description works, it's basically describing something that goes on the screen that's important for the action and understanding the program, and it gets inserted into a more or less quiet part of the soundtrack. And you may have seen it, there's a lot of it out there, especially in public television. Between the times when the actors are talking, a narrator will be saying, she opens the door to the closet and takes out a green coat. Just to describe something important. And it's pretty hard to know what's important until you've seen everything happen. So that's why live and near live exemptions occur. And there is some expansion for video description as time goes by over the next few years. I think it goes out to as far as maybe 2018 and maybe even 2020. Emergency access has been a sore point with the disabled community for years. And as we move to new methods of emergency communications, and this is in both directions, we need to make sure that they're accessible. So you're familiar with emergency alerting, where your television starts beeping and having text on the screen to tell you about a storm or tell you about a fire on the freeway or something like that. So it's a broadcast message, locally relevant for some emergency. This CBA has a requirement on equipment, and this is on all equipment now. This is anything that can receive an emergency alert message, which includes a mobile phone as well as your home television, and that the content also has to be accessible. And they're thinking, you know, given where the major advocacy came from, the focus is on accessible to people with hearing loss or vision loss, either partial or complete from a functional sense. So that's on the broadcast and alerting side. On the incoming side, that is, how can I reach 911, people who are deaf or severely hard of hearing who only had access to text and couldn't use a voice conversation had limitations on 911 calls. They had to call through relay, or they had to make other arrangements, you know, hope that the operator at the public safety answering point had a TTY so that they could have a text conversation, and that always didn't work well. And then as consumers themselves stopped using TTYs and went much more for mobile text on either dedicated devices or on smartphones, the need arose to really force a solution to this access to 911 via text, and we have that now. That's gone into effect, and it really is one of the most dramatic changes in the law, and it's really just the beginning on both of these emergency sides. It's really just the beginning of a whole change of inclusion for emergency purposes of people with all kinds of disabilities. So there's another category covered in CBAA called advanced communication services, and this was a little vague in drafting. We knew that there was a lot of fancy new stuff happening, and we weren't entirely sure what was going to succeed in the market and what the interfaces were going to be like as we were drafting and advocating for the law. So we left a lot of the more tendentious definitions and decisions to the rulemaking process. But the idea behind advanced communication services is that they're basically voice over internet protocol. So that's the very capability that we're using now. We're not using a regular phone line. We're using the internet protocol to communicate by voice. Electronic messaging, which is real-time or near real-time messages, not blogs and things like that, but email, text messaging, and chat, and video conferencing, collaborative platforms as well as plain video conferencing capabilities. And for all of those, there is very full coverage. There are some exceptions. Some things are excluded, but the basic idea is that as these rules go into effect, you'll be able to walk up to any of these advanced communication devices. Could be a computer, could be a kiosk, could be a replacement for a public telephone, or it could be, of course, in your home, a video-capable computer, a VoIP, voice over internet protocol capable computer, a mobile device, a tablet. Anything that can operate by voice and anything that uses electronic messaging and anything that uses video for two-way conversation. Again, this is different from the broadcast side. This is, you know, face-to-face or conferencing groups. You will have access to the hardware, to the software, to the services, and to the content. You'll be able to control the device, you'll be able to navigate the device, you'll be able to control the interface, and you'll be able to either directly get the content or indirectly through some sort of relay process. And this is, again, really revolutionary when you think about it. It's a vision. It's a vision that says, I can create content in whatever form I want. If I want to type, I'll type. If I want to sign, I'll sign. If I want to speak, I'll speak. And I can project that out there across any of these platforms. And then on the receiving side, someone else can have access to the same content how they prefer it. So if I am speaking the content and someone else chooses not to hear me by voice but chooses to get a transcription of it, they have that right. They have that ability to get to receive the content in their preferred form. So I mentioned one of the that there are exemptions and question marks about this. This was an area where industry was most anxious about what was covered and what wasn't, because if you watch this space, you will see huge changes. And we had the question before about a webinar platform, and I would argue that a webinar platform is a collaborative platform, and maybe it wasn't designed to be video conferencing, but it does the same thing, and it's meant to be a communication medium for sharing information. And so if it wasn't covered, maybe we have to go back and get another law that does have it covered. But as soon as any of these platforms add the point-to-point video capability, they do enter into this set of covered systems and software and services. So again, if we were looking at a video here, a live video that I was sending, it would be covered by this. So we could have video captioning, we could have sign language transcription or sign language back and forth, and real-time captioning, and even potentially real-time audio description, since the barrier that we had to audio description in the broadcast mode was there's no way for the user to stop the program and say, what was the color of the coat she took out of the closet. But in a video conference, we do have that capability because everyone's participating is more or less equal. So gaming systems are one example of a hot button issue. We have arguments going on right now from the consumer electronics industry and from the electronic games industry that want gaming systems excluded. And if you know the gaming world, there are a lot of these communication tools built into them. You can talk to the other players in the game, you can text to them, you can message them, and we wanted those to be accessible. One of the reasons that we want them to is it's very unpredictable. Let's say we're talking about an education environment. There's a lot of games that are being used in education, and a lot of educational material that is being moved onto gaming systems. So, we have Khan Academy that's, available through Nintendo, and we have, textbook companies that are offering their stuff on the Xbox. And, what is the limit to those technological changes? Well, there's really none. And so we want to make sure that the accessibility stays current as well. Since we don't know what's going to be happening in the market, we want the FCC to have a hand to it, temporarily offer a waiver or an exemption for those gaming systems, but to keep an eye on what's being used. And if it becomes part of a mainstream function in education or employment or socializing or whatever, to remove those waivers and exemptions and to include gaming systems into the covered the set of devices and services that are covered. Okay, what do you mean by software excluded? So software has a particular status within CVAA, and part of this is the history of, as I was mentioning before, the computer industry. Is it covered by is it a telecommunications function or not? Well, software is an essential part of every piece of ICT hardware out there. If you took all of the software out of your iPhone, you wouldn't have anything. It wouldn't light up. It wouldn't show any screen at all. Now, all of that is being done in software. So in order for it to do its basic functions, it has to do its software. And we know this when they upgrade the software, they change, what's stored within the device, and the device operates differently. So when we think about this from the accessibility perspective, we have to understand, where is the accessibility, where does it reside in the device? And then we also have to recognize that the software industry is not accustomed to being regulated this way. It's accustomed to being, you know, more or less a pure market operation. So there were compromises made about where software is covered and where it isn't. So for example, and I think I showed this in a later slide, if I am a phone company and I'm selling a smartphone, the browser that I bundle with that smartphone, whatever that browser is, that, you know, goes out the door with every client, every customer who comes in and buys that phone gets the same browser because that was installed by contractual relationship with the software company. It's bundled with the phone. That must be accessible. But if the consumer goes out on the web and, you know, goes and downloads another browser onto the phone company isn't responsible for it, and the software company that made that browser is not thought of as subject to FCC regulation. So it isn't required to be accessible. So those are the kind of compromises. I hope I explained it carefully enough. It's not entirely settled, and it's another area where hearing, you know, from the voices of the accessibility community, disabled or not, would really be good for the FCC to understand how these decisions play out in the real world. But software has this kind of hybrid relationship with respect to regulation. I hope that's clear. You can ask the question another way if I didn't quite make it. So some of this about accessible equipment now is going to be going back over what I've said before, just to get an idea down straight of what's covered and what's not. So all of the video hardware in your house, residential video hardware and some other video hardware is covered. So the set-top boxes, the TVs, the remotes, you have to have a button, a captioning button on the remote, which itself is a major advance, that instead of having to figure out how to dive through those on-screen menus to find the captioning to turn it on or turn it off, you're going to have a single button on the remote. Those on-screen menus themselves must be accessible. If I'm blind, there must be a way for me to find out how to, you know, create my list of favorite channels, how to turn on the DVR capability, all of that stuff. The electronic program guide, you know, what's on at 8 p.m. on Disney, all of that information, especially as it concerns being able to record or auto-record or, you know, TiVo that information, that all has to be accessible. And as I said before, the emergency information. I just talked about the browser issues on mobile phones. There's an awful lot that's going on mobile phones now. When the FCC looked at the app world and they saw, you know, 200,000, 500,000 apps out there, they realized that, you know, they couldn't, even if they had the jurisdiction, there's no way that they could regulate or even evaluate the accessibility of all of the stuff that's out there. So it only applies to the things that the covered entities, the phone manufacturers or telecom capable tablet manufacturers and the phone companies, the wireless companies, what they bundle. In addition, we have another great program that we've been missing for a long time. Deafblind folks have really been excluded from telecommunications. If you're aware of the Braille TTYs that are out there, they're north of $5,000 each, and very few of them have gotten purchased any given year. And that meant that deafblind folks had to rely on others to do all or most of their telecommunications captioning, you know, as kind of signing into their hand, a hearing person signing into their hand while they're, you know, talking on the phone to the person at the other end. Not an inclusive environment at all. So there's a section within the Act that says that the FCC can take $10 million a year out of the already established TRS fund, the Relay Service Fund, and use it to purchase and distribute equipment for deafblind consumers. So this should be thousands of new Braille devices that are probably not going to be connected to TTYs, but they're going to be connected to iPads and iPhones and other tablets and mobile phones like that. This is, just a brand new world for these folks as well, and a very important one. The FCC is going through right now its certification of state programs for this equipment distribution program. So there are some other items within the Act. There's a requirement for hearing aid compatibility on anything that works like a phone that you pick up to your ear. That's the definition that they had to come up with, because we're doing a lot of phone stuff by computer, VoIP. A lot of people are doing only by their desktop computer, and that is not a covered item. But if it's an iPhone or a tablet that you're using as if it were a phone, that's got to have the same hearing aid compatibility capabilities as the wireless phone and the wireline phone. There's a record-keeping obligation, which sounds very nerdy and off-topic. What it basically says is that companies that manufacture these devices and software and phones and whatever is covered have to keep track of what they did to keep the information to make those products accessible. So, as the note says, part of that is their efforts to consult with people with disabilities. So I know a lot of companies that I consider to be, best practices who maintain a panel of, excuse me a second, sorry, who maintain a panel of consumers with disabilities and other experts on accessibility, who submit designs to them for review, who go out and recruit people to test products that are as prototypes, to get briefings on, what are the current hot button items for disability advocacy groups. There's a wide range of activities that companies can do to consult with these folks. And again, all of the big companies are doing a pretty good job of consulting. The advantage of this record-keeping requirement is that a corporate executive has to sign off on it. And if you look at the world from the perspective of a corporate executive, if they sign something, it better be accurate. It better not be something that turns around and bites them later. So this is an attempt to motivate the company to pay more rigorous attention internally to this and not just make it something that they do as an afterthought. They do some PR, maybe they buy a, they support an accessibility conference once a year. This is to make it part of how the company does its business. And we'll see what kind of effect that has. So I hope that answered your question as well. Another piece of the law requires the FCC to establish a clearinghouse of information about accessible products. And you folks, many of you are involved in information services, information resource about accessible technology and about assistive technology. And this is a way of mainstreaming some of that requirement. So the idea is that manufacturers of all of this equipment and software companies and what have you will either create their own way of storing that information and the FCC can tap into it, or those companies will just tell the FCC the information and the FCC will put it on its clearinghouse. And there's a lot of opportunities for making improvements there. And then the CBAA created a much simpler method of making complaints for consumers to, talk about their experiences, negative experiences with all of these products and services, and requires the FCC to do a kind of a more intensive job of managing those complaints and responding to them. So I hope that one of the things I've been able to get across is how this might be relevant to your work. And this is definitely on the mainstream side of things. Now, I'm not one of these people who thinks, the assistive technology is going away, that we don't need it anymore, we just, you know, rely on our mainstream devices, because there's a lot of problems there. Those devices are doing a great job right now with their operating systems and with the apps that are available to run on them, and that's certainly true on the laptop and desktop computer world as well. But the problem that we have with mainstream technologies is that we have a funding issue. Medicaid won't pay for an iPad. Well, they will pay for an assistive technology device that's been identified within the Medicaid rule. So we have, and certainly in the education world, we face the same kind of funding issues. People are worried about, you know, everyone in the class wanting to get a free iPad and what that'll do to budgets and classroom management, et cetera. So we have to manage that. We have an enforcement issue where mainstream companies are not always going to be strongly motivated. It's not a major part of their business. It's a sidebar to their business. So they're not as motivated in making it work as well. An assistive technology company, accessibility is their business, and so you don't have an enforcement problem, you just kind of have a market problem. And information and support. How do we find out about these accessibility features on these mainstream devices? The documentation is poor. If you go to the retail store, you won't be able to get help most of the time from the retail folks there. They haven't gotten training on the accessibility. And how do you get answers to questions? You know, again, with the AT world, they're so focused on the needs of these users that they're very good at information and support, and we can't get that from mainstream folks. And then churn, which is just an industry term for, you know, this product came onto the market and, you know, 6 months or 18 months later, it was gone. It was replaced by something. The accessibility feature I've relied on isn't there anymore. The one I have is just about broken. What do I do? And again, so it's a continuity and a focus on the needs of people with disabilities that mainstream companies just don't have. But that being said, there's an awful lot of good stuff going on there as well. And, you know, I think that everyone, you know, looks at the iPad and the iOS in general as really having revolutionized the accessibility arena overall. So here comes the pitch. Every good sales talk, I guess, ends with the closing where, you know, I try to get you to sign up for some of these things. So I'd like to offer you, the thrill of participating in regulatory proceedings. That when I review them, and I review a lot of these, I don't see enough comments from consumers with disabilities and from the rest of the accessible technology community. Professionals and others. And on the disability category side, we certainly don't see enough from people with dexterity disabilities or people with cognitive disabilities. So, you know, think about joining into that dialogue. It's a lot easier to do than you might think, and I'll be sending around URLs that show you on the FCC website. You just, you know, fill out the form with the item number that you're commenting on, a little bit of demographics and usual, you know, way of reaching back to you, and then you can literally type into a text box or upload a document, a short one-page thing that describes what your opinion is and why. Just because CVAA is, let's say, 80 or 85% finished in its current proceedings, it doesn't mean that there's not a lot more happening. There's a lot happening. CVAA is happening, and we know about the ADA being applied to the web. That will be the subject of a huge public inquiry, public notices, opportunities to comment in the next year or so. We have laws that are going to be coming up as well. We've got the Rehab Act, which is going to have to be reauthorized pretty soon. We've got the implications of the Affordable Care Act, all of which have implications for us. There was a question before about the health exchanges, and there's been pressure on CMS, Center for Medicaid Systems or something like that. I'm not sure what the name is. It's within HHS. how accessible are those resources going to be? You know, if I was accustomed to going to my county welfare office, and they're shutting down the welfare office and requiring everyone to apply online for services, then those services better be accessible. Those websites better be accessible. Those online forms better be accessible. So we have an awful lot of stuff coming down the road. All of the programs that we've been working with that continually need to be updated and upgraded as far as accessibility. We've got Section 508, which is important not just in the federal arena, but the states and the universities and school districts and municipal governments have adopted that public procurement of ICT also has to be accessible. And we need to have the voice of consumers and those who speak on behalf of consumers and service providers to consumers to say how those programs need to work, what's going to make things have a benefit that actually reaches the consumers. And that goes, you know, Medicare, Medicaid, voc rehab, education, the Aging and Disability Resource Centers, this newly formed Administration on Community Living. What a great opportunity for us to get in early with a way of building their program so accessibility and via AT or via mainstream equipment is built into how they manage those community living programs and how the administration itself oversees those programs. And then we've got state equipment distribution programs that used to be just for TTYs. Many states are looking at other ways of supporting people with other disabilities. And so that's a state level activity that you folks can have a lot of impact on. There's a need for the expertise, for the clinical expertise and the programmatic expertise and the understanding of the needs of people with disabilities. And then implementation. I'd encourage you, if you have an opportunity to work with industry on one of those panels, or if you know an engineer or a designer, or you go to a usability meeting, or you have a chance to talk with someone in marketing or marketing communications about accessibility, some way of getting past the PR armor that companies have and into the working level, you know, people who are actually making things work differently within those companies. And be specific. You know, these folks are not accessibility or disability specialists. If you say your product needs to be more accessible, they'll nod and smile at you, but they won't know what you mean. If you say users should be able to change the size of the font and the color of the font, And that will allow low vision users to use the product. That's something that's something that at least they can put on the bulletin board, you know, of features that might make it into the next release. Then there are complaints. You know, that I was saying that CBAA makes the informal complaints easier to launch, and it does. It's really quite easy. If you see a mistake in captioning, if you see description where it missing where it should be, and especially when you see interfaces on, you know, telecommunications platforms of all types, chat or blogging, but like social media like Twitter, interfaces where there should be more accessibility and there just isn't, figure out some way to get that complaint in. It's really quite easy to do, and the FCC will do the heavy lifting. They have staff who reviews those complaints and takes the responsibility for communicating with industry. The FCC clearinghouse I was talking about, I'm hoping to see the FCC move in a direction of making that more of an open information source. So it's not the FCC as the hub of everything, but that anyone who has some useful information, that includes mainstream companies, it certainly includes AT companies, it includes consumers with disabilities who are the repository of all of the useful tips and tricks about how to make things work together. People in the clinical world, AT practitioners of various types, they all have some information that cannot be found some other way. So I'd like to see it more as an open community of practice, and we're doing what we can to move the FCC in that direction. Okay, so at this point, you may have some additional questions. My questions here are, you know, and I'd really encourage and ask you to get back to me on this. What is it within your organization and how you do your job that CBAA and other laws that affect mainstream technologies, how are they going to affect how you do your job and how your clients get benefit from accessibility? What do you need organizationally, and what can others do at the policy level to help you push out the benefit of these laws to a wider and wider circle? So with that, I think that's all I had. And if there are questions, I'd be happy to take additional questions now.
Thanks, Jim. That's wonderful. We do have a couple of questions that I was taking note of during the course of your presentation. The most recent one, I think, is still visible within the chat room, is that concerning the FCC clearinghouse. Is that readily found on their site, or do you have a URL that people can use to access the FCC clearinghouse?
If you hold on and give me another question, I'll go dig the URL and paste it into the chat.
Okay, that's okay, great. The other question that was of interest to me, and I think this is probably not an easily answered question, you were talking earlier in the session about the value chain of closed captioning and just how many interest parties are involved in the process. How do you think this is really going to work in real life? Do you see that there will be collaboration between these various interest groups, or is it really going to be hit and miss?
Okay, so I just pasted in the clearinghouse URL. That's the home page of it, and it's not loaded with information everywhere. You kind of have to dig down and look for where they have more information and less. And in point of fact, if you would report what you found there, as you know, whether it was valuable or not so valuable, that might help us, you know, generate some more momentum for the clearinghouse, the effort in general. So the value chain is always a risk, because, you know, you get these finger pointing situations where the, you know, AT&T says it's the, you know, Apple's problem, and Apple says it's AT&T's problem, and that's a real, you know, that doesn't benefit anybody. So what has to happen really is for the FCC to understand this issue and to parcel out the responsibilities. You know, the studios understand their responsibility. When they're creating video content, they understand how to put the captioning in there. But and the cable companies do, you know, and the satellite companies and fiber companies do as well. You know, they're a little more remote from it because they mostly have a pass-through responsibility. You know, they have to make sure that the captioning doesn't get stripped out in the act of taking it across their transmission facilities. But there are a whole bunch of little players there, and I'll give you an example, you know, that aren't so aware of it. So that would be like the, you know, if you make third-party television remote controls, you know, the aftermarket ones, the novelty ones or the large print ones or whatever, the ones that don't come in the box with the TV, you won't necessarily know about the requirements for the closed circuit, the closed captioning button, or you know how the menus have to work and all of that. Another example: we had a situation which, with cables, the HDMI cables, it's a high definition multimedia interface cables. You may be familiar with if you have a relatively new TV. They're great. They're data cables that can send audio and video, and they're self-configuring, and they're just wonderful. But the problem is that they can't transmit the captioning data. They can transmit a video signal that already has the captioning exposed on it, but not one that has the unencoded text of the caption in the data stream. And that's a problem if you've got many different gadgets in your home theater set up. You've got a DVD and a set-top box and a TV and, you know, maybe some other things, and you're trying to connect them with HDMI cables. So if they're not the individuals who designed the HDMI interface didn't know about captioning requirements. They were remote from it and, you know, never got the word. So that value chain is always going to be something you have to watch over very, very carefully. And it's another thing we're trying to get the FCC to do what we call a horizon scan. Not to wait for something to get introduced into the market that's inaccessible, but to go to those early meetings where prototypes are being shown and industry standards are being written, and, you know, raise your hand and say, whoa, 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 what have you thought about this accessibility issue? And you should know that the product you're talking about is going to be covered by this law, this regulation, and to get a little bit ahead of the picture, because industry, you know, is they get pretty annoyed when you come to them when they've just introduced the product and tell them that, you know, that it's got a big flaw in it. You don't really have any power to take the product off the market, it appears, but they're not happy to get bad news about something they were hoping to get, you know, just good news on. And we can do a better job of warning them in advance about this. And, of course, they can do a better job as well. So, you know, I hope that's kind of responsive to that value chain issue. We have an SAP question. Conversion. Yeah, well, that's right. The SAP channel is no longer in the picture, but there's plenty of second and third and fourth and fifth audio capabilities in digital video. So yes, all of those standards are in place. All of the companies in the value chain understand how to provide audio description, and you know, I don't think that there's a technical problem. I think the problem is the compliance problem, and what will we see as those regulations come into effect. CBAA has any effect on strategies for vital or essential government records or archives? No, again, this is kind of is this covered by the ADA or other regulations? And, you know, that whole question about archived material and, you know, do you need to have a text version of an archived, let's say, a historical document, and what is how do you prioritize those records? You know, obviously something like the Constitution, you know, is an old document that wasn't digital at first, but we have many, many digital versions of it. At the other end of the spectrum, what is the priority for creating a machine-readable version of some much more obscure government document, less essential, with much less of a requirement for use? So where do we draw that line and how do we prioritize? Those are subject to other rules. Section 508 certainly has a lot to say about that. It's one of the lively areas within that. And that is a rulemaking that's currently in process. If you've been following Section 508, we had already two advanced notice of proposed rulemakings and comments on them. The Access Board is now taking that information and trying to revise it into a final rule. We think we're maybe a year away from seeing that, maybe a year and a half away from it being in effect. It's taken a long, long time, unfortunately, but, you know, some of that is a response to these trickier issues of trying to identify what has to be archived in government records. Qualitative standards for video description, it's the same as it was. I mean, it basically says, you know, there's a phrase in there, and I don't remember it offhand, but it's really the definition of video description. It has to be sufficient for, and I'm paraphrasing here completely, it has to be sufficient for the comprehension of the video programming. So if you've got a lot of silent action, you've got to have a lot of description going on so that when the person comes out the other end of that silent portion of the program, they know what the heck is happening and they can follow the purpose of the program. Uh,
Okay, it looks like we're about at the end of our questions. If anybody does have a last question, please feel free to put that into the chat show right now. Jim, just one question for you. Is you have asked these very important questions on your screen. Is there any way that people can respond to those to you? I know that certainly from our point of view, if people were to go to our website, which is the accessibletech.org, we do have a form submission ability on that website that people could certainly send some responses that way. But is there any way in particular that you think that people could get to you? And I see you have put that on the screen, that is Tobias, T-O-B-I-A-S, at inclusive.com. So I really would encourage people to put as much information as they can into writing for us and to Jim so that we can really do a good job of correlating all this information. So thank you for all of your questions. Jim, do you have a last comment for us?
I see there's another question about applying to accessibility in the workplace, and I'm just not going to repeat what I said before about the, you know, if accessibility was required by another law, CBAA doesn't really say anything in addition to it. But one thing is different, I think, a little bit, and that is that there's a whole trend called consumerization, which basically means consumer ICT services and products being adopted by workplaces. So, you know, we now have companies that use Twitter internally, and we have companies that use, all kinds of gadgets and software and web capabilities like wikis and what have you that weren't designed for employment purposes, but they work perfectly. And one of the things that I think is going to happen is, again, kind of a halo effect. CBAA is going to require more captioning, more access to transcoding services like Relay, where we can have text converted to speech and speech converted to text and video converted to text and all of those capabilities, that as that infrastructure grows, the workplace will, you know, kind of inherit some of that. So as a legal question, it doesn't apply, but I think as a question of reality, if you're in the world of voc rehab, you'll get a lot of payoff from the fact that this entire ecosystem vision is emerging of, I create content however I want to, and you receive that content however you want to, and all of these network services and software models in the cloud that happen in between us, it almost doesn't matter how the content was created at first because everyone's happy receiving it the way they want. That has, you know, just a lot of workplace applications. So I guess in closing, I just, you know, want to thank you all again for attending. This is a really nice, large audience. I'm very happy to have this chance. I hope some of the things I've said made sense and made sense not just by themselves, but in how you look at your work and how you look at serving your clients and how your organizations are planning for the future. Very much like to have you all involved in mainstream ICT accessibility policy. There's a LinkedIn group. If you're on LinkedIn, just search for Accessible Technology Policy Group. We always want to see more people who are in the trenches there and not just, you know, Washington folks. And, you know, happy to answer any of your questions personally about, you know, these, how you can get more involved or what these implications are for you.
Great. Jim, I have to say this has really been so informative and we really appreciate it. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful, extremely enlightening, and has certainly given me some ideas of where we can continue with this process, and one of which I think would be very interesting from an accessible technology point of view would be looking at the whole field of transcoding and how that works from a technology standpoint, a very interesting field in itself. So much to think about, and I would echo Jim's comments that we'd love to see people get more involved in the whole rulemaking process, and let's get some input into that process. So sadly, that's as much as we have for today. Thank you again for participating. And for those of you who may still have questions for our speakers and maybe didn't have a chance to get your questions out there, please do feel free to contact your regional ADA center. And the number for that is 1-800-949-4232. That's 800-949-4232, and that is TTY enabled too. So Jim, once again, thank you so much. That's Jim Tobias from Inclusive Technologies, and we look forward to having you again in future webinars for us. And I think that's it for today. Thank you all for attending, and we look forward to seeing you in August for our next webinar, which will be looking at the accessibility of some of our web authoring tools. So a little bit more technical and a less legal aspect. Thanks again from us to all of you.